the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 31st, 2023. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and from the front page of today's Gazette, where does Iowa go next on water quality? Nutrient reduction strategy, 10 years of ups and downs. This is the final installment of a two-part series on 10 years of the nutrient reduction strategy and its rippling impacts on Iowa's water quality by Brittany Miller of the Gazette. When Alex Linderwell was in high school, the pump for the private well in his family's Manchester home had to be replaced. They decided to test the water they'd been drinking for years. Linderwell remembers it coming back with nitrate levels higher than the safe drinking water limit, which wasn't surprising, he said. Private wells in Delaware County, tucked in northeast Iowa's karst region, are prone to contamination due to the area's porous geography and heavy agricultural presence. His family installed a reverse osmosis system to filter out the nutrient. I honestly didn't really give it much of a thought, he said. Little did I know I would end up being the person that comes out to test that well water. Linderwell, now 26, is the administrator of the Delaware County Water and Sanitation Department, who is responsible for private well water testing. He has seen nitrate levels reach as high as 60 milligrams per liter, six times the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's safe drinking water level of 10 milligrams per liter. Around 27% of Delaware County's nitrate tests came back above 10 milligrams per liter. That's well above Iowa's average of elevated nitrate test results, which between 2011 and 2020, which is 15%, according to state data. Nitrate levels above the safe drinking water limit can cause deadly blue baby syndrome in infants. Long-term exposure to lower nitrate levels, even for adults, could lead to cancer and other negative health impacts, emerging research suggests. It represents one of the many consequences of Iowa's battle with nutrient pollution. Agrochemicals, like fertilizer, were responsible for 10% of the fish that died in Iowa fish kills since 1981, according to Investigate Midwest reporting. Those impacts multiply as nutrients from across the Mississippi River Basin make their way down to the Gulf of Mexico hypoxic, or dead zone. Nitrogen and phosphorus can also disrupt public water supplies, causing facilities like Des Moines Water Works to spend up to $10,000 a day operating nitrate removal technology. For the final installment of the Ripple Effect series, the Gazette interviewed water quality experts, government officials, and advocacy groups to answer the question, after a decade of Iowa's nutrient reduction strategy, after some successes and several challenges, where do we go from here? While Iowa's modeled phosphorus load has shown improvements, the state has made negligible progress over the last decade in decreasing its nitrogen pollution, according to Iowa State University's Nutrient Reduction Strategy Data Dashboard. Five-year flow-weighted averages, which help smooth out the influence of rainfall or drought, of nitrate loads in 2021 were actually higher than those in 2012, a year before the strategy was implemented. We're stable to a little bit behind our original starting point, said Jamie Benning, ISU's Assistant Director for Agriculture and Natural Resources Extension. She partly attributes that to an increase in nitrogen fertilizer application. Fluctuating corn and soybean acreage within the past decade, largely influenced by policy changes, also contributes to nitrogen loans, especially when perennial land cover enrolled in the U.S. Department of Agriculture Conservation Reserve Program shifts back to row crops. Corn yields have seen an upward trajectory in the past decade, which may encourage farmers to use even more fertilizer on their fields to maintain profits, added Matt Helmers, director of ISU's Nutrient Research Center. Many nitrogen-focused conservation practices, like saturated buffers and bioreactors, also are relatively new to the water quality scene. Practices that prevent soil loss, and thus the loss of sediment-bound phosphorus, have been around much longer. It's really only the last 10 years that we've focused on nitrogen reduction, certainly in the same way that we've historically focused on sediment and phosphorus reduction, Helmer said. There's so much more to do. One potential avenue toward cutting Iowa's nitrogen pollution could be ISU's Iowa Nitrogen Initiative, a study of nitrogen fertilizer application in search of best management practices that boost corn productivity while avoiding runoff. The project aims to revise a long-standing fertilizer calculator used in seven corn-growing states. This summer, the university and its partners completed 270 on-farm trials on 148 fields between 72 farm operators. The trial results will be available in early 2024. They may uncover site-specific recommendations for farmers to reduce their fertilizer use and resulting nutrient runoff. Any progress the nutrient reduction strategy has made thus far has been slow-moving. In a 2022 report, the Iowa Environmental Council calculated how long it would take Iowa to reach one of the strategy's example scenarios for non-point source nutrient reduction. Based on progress through 2018, the report authors found it would take 85 years to reach 12.6 million acres of using cover crops, 942 years to reach 7.7 million acres treated by wetlands, and 22,325 years to reach 6 million acres treated by bioreactor and saturated buffers. Ultimately, a strategy has to be judged by the outcomes, said the Council's Water Program Director, Alicia Vasto, and the outcomes are not just there. In November, Dan Voss geared up to plant camelina, a cover crop, across some of his 600-acre farm near Palo. It's a conservation practice he has dutifully adhered to since the 1980s, along with no-till. He already has one saturated buffer and one bioreactor on his land. By the end of 2024, he's hoping for two more bioreactors and three more saturated buffers. It's those conservation actions that led to his accolade as the Iowa Farm Bureau's 2023 Iowa Conservation Farmer of the Year. It's a win-win for farmers. Shoot, it doesn't cost them anything, Voss said about conservation practices like his own that were completed within strategic patchworks of conservation practices called batch and build initiatives that aim to improve water quality in bulk. We really can make progress, and we can reduce the dead zone. The agriculture community, we need to get with it. In the 2023 farm poll, 64% of rental farmer respondents indicated that their landlord had not spent any money on conservation practices for their largest parcel of land over the previous 10 years. 57% of renters reported spending some amount of their own money on such practices in the same time frame, and most agreed it was their responsibility to address the conservation needs on the land they rent. We're moving in the right direction in terms of awareness, knowledge, and adoption practices, Arbuckle said. It's just that we're going much more slowly than we would like in order to actually make the types of progress that we would like. Also from the front page, Audit Finds Conflict in UI Hospital Project in North Liberty, by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. 4 years ago, in the wake of an over-budget children's hospital project plagued by design changes, construction delays, mismanagement, and cost overruns, University of Iowa Facilities Management assumed oversight control of all forthcoming UI healthcare construction to, among other things, mitigate any future challenges. But the UI shift in leadership and decision-making power has meant significant challenges for the $525.6 million hospital campus it's building in North Liberty, according to an October 18th audit by Baker Tilly, provided to the Gazette through an open records request. A significant challenge on this project is the communication between UI Facilities Management Design and Construction and UIHC Capital Management, according to the audit, reporting a gap in understanding between UI Design and Construction and UIHC and the respective ownership of responsibilities, which has caused a potential lack of information sharing throughout the project. The key disagreement between the two departments is who the true owner of the project is. UI Healthcare is the ultimate owner of the 469,000 square foot hospital rising on a 60-acre plot near the intersection of Forever Green Road and Highway 965. But J.E. Dunn's construction management contract is with UI Design and Construction, making J.E. Dunn contractually obligated to defer to the UI D&C team. This has created challenges due to UIHC's expectations from J.E. Dunn and caused constraints to overall project management, according to the audit, flagging spending discord on things like furniture, medical equipment, and information technology. There appears to be a gap in procedural understanding with UI D&C and how a UIHC arrived at these budget amounts or how they are managed, according to the audit, which the audit presented in generalities and bullet points to the Board of Regents in November. When asked whether any regents requested or read the full audit report provided to the Gazette upon its request, Board spokesman Josh Lehman said regents received the public presentation at the November meeting and had the opportunity to ask questions. In response to the recent audit findings, tying design changes to budget increases, UI officials pointed back to soaring inflation post-COVID. Material and labor costs fluctuated on a monthly basis, and it was an impossible task to anticipate future costs when suppliers would not or could not guarantee pricing on their products, according to the UI audit response. Acknowledging difficulties in cost control when designs are not complete and are fully vetted, UI officials told auditors their chosen project delivery method was designed to involve a wide range of assumptions before many design decisions are finalized. It is important to realize that projects of this complexity and scale are not designed in a short time frame, according to the university response. A great deal of time is required, years in fact, to meet with the entirety of staff that need input into the design. The university response noted two significant events occur during these elongated timeframes. First, some of the original users of the new building leave and are replaced with new staff that have differing ideas of what the design should be. Second, new medical equipment comes on the market. Replacing the previously designed equipment with the newer models is almost always desired, UI officials reported. This clearly has cost implications for not only the equipment, but the spaces and infrastructure to support those newer pieces of equipment. Turning to the Iowa Today and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, Iowa turns down federal food aid. Iowa has turned down millions in federal aid for low-income children, instead opting to expand state-funded programs and avoid spending $2.2 million a year on administration. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the federal summer EBT program is not sustainable and does not provide long-term solutions for the issues impacting children and families. The program would have provided children who receive free and reduced lunch with $40 a month during the summer to supplement food costs. Reynolds further said the state would invest in programs that do a better job of promoting nutrition. Democrats and family advocates decried the decision and said Iowa children would lose out as a result. ISU Addiction Recovery Program grows. Iowa State University's Collegiate Recovery Program recently underwent accreditation, making it one of just 10 college addiction recovery programs nationwide to be considered a fully reviewed program. Officials said it would make the program better equipped to reach out to students and prospective students. Traffic deaths at 7-year high. More people have died on Iowa's roadways this year than in each of the last 6 years, according to the Iowa Department of Transportation. There have been 372 road fatalities as of late December, a 10% increase from last year. Authorities pin the increase on distracted and impaired driving, as well as excessive speeding. Judge to decide on Iowa book ban law. A federal judge will decide by January 1st whether to temporarily block enforcement of a new state law that bans books with sexual content from school libraries and prohibits teaching about sexual orientation and gender identity before 7th grade. Two groups are suing state officials over the law, arguing it violates First Amendment rights, and the judge has actually temporarily halted that ban on the books, but not the teaching of gender identity through K through 6. Under the heading They Said, if we're talking 20-some million dollars coming from the federal government, I don't think the state is going to be matching that. They're just going to be leaving it to the charities to make up the difference. Senator Sarah Trone Garriott, Democrat West Des Moines, on Iowa refusing federal food aid. And federal COVID-era cash benefit programs are not sustainable and don't provide long-term solutions for the issues impacting children and families. An EBT card does nothing to promote nutrition at a time when childhood obesity has become an epidemic. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on decision to refuse federal food aid. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Iowa Hoops, the Iowa women's basketball team maintained its number 4 spot in the Associated Press rankings this past week as star Caitlin Clark continues to lead the team to a dominant season. Clark, who ranks 7th in career points in NCAA Division I history, has a chance to break the all-time scoring record by the end of the current season. Reward for missing man. Officials in Sac County are offering a $2,000 reward for information about missing Wall Lake trucker David Schultz. The man disappeared last month under mysterious circumstances when his truck was found unattended on a rural county road. And under the heading Water Cooler, Dort Trump Rally. A Donald Trump rally scheduled for January 5th at Dort University in Sioux Center was relocated because of a disagreement between the university and Trump's campaign. In a statement, Dort said the Trump campaign started the process of lining up a campaign stop but desired a rally format and said Trump's campaign publicized earlier than expected. The rally now will be held at an event center in Sioux Center. An Isle Casino crash. A Nebraska man has been arrested after leading police on a brief chase at the Isle Casino in Waterloo last week. Police say Brian Joseph Melber struck a police car after officers approached his car in the casino parking lot. He then struck a utility pole on a nearby road, attempted to run, but fell and injured his hip, police say. Turning to the Insight page, Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, Reynolds has nerve to say no to extra SNAP dollars. On Friday, December 22nd, Governor Kim Reynolds and the heads of the Iowa Departments of Education and Health and Human Services announced that Iowa had notified the U.S. Department of Agriculture that the state would decline participation in the Summer Electronic Benefits Transfer for Children program, also known as Summer EBT. The federal program, designed as a temporary pandemic-related benefit that was only made permanent earlier this year, would have provided $40 monthly in the form of an EBT card for 3 months over the summer in the name of any child eligible for free or reduced-price meals during the school year. The decision was bound to elicit screams of anguish from Reynolds' political opposition, but that's what they do, scream at every action and decision. Of Aristotle's three modes of persuasion, the progressive left revels in pathos, the appeal to a person's emotion. Often that's at the expense of logos, the appeal to logic and reason, and ethos, the appeal of one's own character and sensibility. To the pathological left, Kim Reynolds and her Republican cohorts are the villains they crave in order to appeal to your sense of fear and anger. Reopen shuttered schools only 6 months into the pandemic, Kim Reynolds wants kids and teachers to die. Champion school choice and sign it into law, Kim Reynolds wants to yank education funding and give it all to uppity private schools for rich kids. Decline a federal program because of administrative costs and less than ideal outcomes, Kim Reynolds wants children to starve. It gets a bit tiresome. A more reasoned thinker might dare to look at the big picture and consider the arguments that Reynolds and her administration are making. Reynolds cited administrative nuisance and concerns that SNAP benefits do not fulfill the nutritional obligations to the hungry as childhood obesity remains a rising concern. Those are valid points. Even federal programs that promise funding for the offered benefits almost always involve monetary costs for the state that administer them. The summer EBT program requires that states pay 50% of the administrative costs and administer the summer EBT program separately from the existing SNAP program. It wouldn't have been as simple as tossing extra cash onto existing EBT cards. Reynolds' administration estimated that separately brokering 3 months of $40 benefits for kid through an EBT card would cost the state $2.2 million in administrative expenditures. That's not a negligible figure. It's a good 10% of the administrative cost the state incurred for the entire SNAP program in fiscal 2020. The $2.2 million figure also represents a significant increase in administrative costs as a percentage of the overall benefits issued when compared to the same from fiscal 2020. Numbers and statistics appeal to our sense of logic, but even the most unimpassioned thinker can be saddened by the realities of increasing childhood obesity. Between 2017 and 2020, more than 1 in 5 children ages 6 to 19 in the United States were considered obese. Children from low-income households tend to be less physically fit and face a higher risk of obesity than children from higher-income households. Obese children also are more likely to remain obese as adults. No one, including Governor Reynolds or your friendly neighborhood opinion columnist who was formerly obese, is suggesting that SNAP participation is a cause of childhood obesity. Nevertheless, obesity and nutrition, or lack thereof, are inextricably linked, and while households that do not receive SNAP benefits also are below the bar, households receiving SNAP benefits fare even worse when it comes to healthy food purchases. A November 2016 USDA report analyzed point-of-sale data from over 127 million SNAP EBT transactions. Over 22% of those dollars were spent on junk foods and sugary drinks. The number one purchase by SNAP households was pop, making up 5% of the SNAP dollars spent. Throw in fruit juices, energy drinks, and sweetened teas, and that makes 10%. Importantly, the point-of-sale data analyzed did not include any convenience store transactions. The evil giant rearing its ugly head right next to childhood hunger is childhood nutrition. Reynolds' argument is that extra SNAP dollars do nothing to address the nutritional deficits of hungry children. The summer EBT program might provide short-term food access, but short-term solutions are very good at stalling meaningful change or impeding it altogether. If Iowa is to invest in more resources, argues Reynolds, Iowa should pursue opportunities that will work. If the federal government wants its programs to lead on childhood nutrition, it should allow states the flexibility to tailor them to our state's needs. Some attempts have been made to tailor SNAP benefits. In Iowa, legislators in 2023 proposed limiting SNAP-eligible purchases to foods approved under the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, called WIC. Those limitations are arguably too stringent. WIC benefits can't be used even on basic white bread, and a required waiver from the USDA would have likely been denied. Other jurisdictions have tried smaller approaches. In 2010, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg requested that the federal government allow the city to try out a ban on SNAP purchases of sugary drinks. It was denied. The state of Maine made requests of both the Obama and Trump administrations to allow them to prohibit buying candy or sugary drinks with SNAP benefits. Denied and denied. Evolutionary biologist and former university professor Brett Weinstein put it best in a May 2022 tweet in which he stated that human beings who exist today do so in a world in which nutrients that limited your ancestors are readily available in limitless abundance, even for those of modest means. Worse still, continues Weinstein, what harms you enriches vendors who spend huge sums triggering your desire. In their denial of Maine's second request, the USDA cited administrative costs to retailers, which indeed wouldn't have been cheap. But it brings up an important question. If state or federal legislators were to introduce a bill to prevent SNAP dollars from being used on pop and candy, would it get enough support? Or would anyone who profits from the sale of pop and candy, like grocers, beverage distributors, and convenience store chains, throw resources behind blocking the change? We must realize that we no longer live in a world where the nutritional needs of the poor are solely or even squarely focused on getting enough calories. The American diet has changed dramatically over the last century. Food production, distribution, processing, and preservation have all made huge advancements, and it's too easy to favor the sweet and salty over the wholesome and healthy. Sadly, lower-income households are especially vulnerable to poor diet choices. The Reynolds administration turning down the summer EBT program isn't some gutsy political win for her, but leadership sometimes requires being the bad guy. Public entities at any level tend to reflexively buy into any program that gets free dollars from a higher governing authority. It takes a real spine to say no, especially when your opposition yowls without ceasing. Help doesn't begin and end with government programs, nor should it ever. Those who bemoan the summer EBT declination can still do plenty to fight child hunger. Our opinion section has received a number of letters on the subject using words like shame and Scrooge. Not one of them suggests making a regular donation to a food bank in the form of money or volunteer time. Or maybe reaching out to the single mom who lives down the street to see if she needs her kids' lunches covered on no school days. Even those whose voices can reach further haven't seemed to consider that. On Friday, State Representative Sammy Sheets posted a video on social media he'd taken outside a local nonprofit with a dedicated food bank, in which he talked about the increase in demand the organization had experienced. Instead of an appeal for renewed local help, Sheets took the opportunity to rail on how state leaders don't give a damn about child hunger. Republican politicians are letting kids starve, reads the video's caption. The only ones who are actually believe that are people who already hate Republicans, and theirs is a hunger for loathing that will never be sated. Now, Todd Dorman today, we do have a guest column from Lanisha Castle. Lanisha Castle is the executive director of the African American Museum of Iowa, and she writes in Iowa Treasure, African American Museum of Iowa reopening this spring in Cedar Rapids. In the works since late 2019, the African American Museum of Iowa is excited we are nearing the light at the end of the renovation tunnel. The museum's multi-million dollar renovation project is almost complete. While we are looking forward to the finishing touches and the return of the collection to its home, we are excited for the opportunity to showcase this project with a ribbon-cutting ceremony at 10 a.m. February 27th. As a statewide museum, we are grateful to have representatives from the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance, the Marion Chamber of Commerce, and the West Des Moines Chamber of Commerce joining us as we mark this important step. The event is open to the public, and the museum encourages communities from across the state to participate in the momentous occasion. The fully renovated museum boasts a modern and welcoming new entrance, expanded lobby, new roof, sprinkler system, as well as updated and modern features throughout. The museum is grateful for the support of our members, donors, and especially to our Voices Inspiring Progress Capital Campaign supporters, including the City of Cedar Rapids, Hall Perrine Foundation, Roy J. Carver Charitable Trust, and the State of Iowa. When the museum officially reopens, anticipated for early April, we will celebrate by taking patrons down memory lane with our new exhibit, 30 Years of the AAMI. This exhibit will feature highlights from the museum's 30-year history. The museum's milestone anniversary in 2023 included an Eastern and a Central Iowa celebration and a statewide programming and collaborations. These commemorations were great lead-ins to the long-awaited reopening. The African American Museum is an Iowa treasure and has been a voice for the voiceless for more than 30 years. It leads the effort to tear down the walls that confine us to a limited history. The AAMI provides its audiences with the richness of Iowa's full history. No other institution in the state understands the scope of that history and has the resources to make it available to our youth, families, and communities like the African American Museum. The continuing need for inclusive and authentic history is why the African American Museum of Iowa was founded and why it is necessary for all Iowans today and tomorrow. This work would not be possible without the dedicated support of the community, especially the many individual donors, corporations, and foundations who have helped support the museum's capital campaign, Voices Inspiring Progress. With just $1 million left to raise, which will increase our endowment and cement our long-lasting legacy for generations to come, we're quickly approaching our $6 million goal. To join us in this ambitious campaign, visit blackiowa.org/VIP to make a year-end gift. And we have a guest column from Gazette editorial fellow Sophia DiMartino, Avoiding Senior Scammers. Last Christmas, my grandmother told me over scrambled eggs and buttered toast about the phone calls she had been receiving. The caller said, "Hi, Grandma, it's me, your grandson." I asked them, "Oh, really? What's going on?" The guy said he was in jail and needed money to bail him out. I stopped chewing and looked up at her from the same table where she had slid me plates of eggs and toast for decades. Her only grandson is my only son, who had been away in training for months. "You didn't give anyone any information or money," I insisted. "Oh, no, I knew it wasn't him. It didn't even sound like him." I breathed a sigh of relief. The National Council on Aging counts the grandparent scam, in which fraudsters impersonate a grandchild in need, among the top five financial scams targeting older adults in the United States. According to an AARP study, an estimated $28.3 billion is lost to senior financial fraud each year. Although the federal government launched a massive investigation in the 1990s that resulted in hundreds of convictions, telemarketing scams still are widely in use. In the spring of 2021, cast member Jen Shah of the popular Real Housewives franchise was convicted and sentenced to 6.5 years in prison for operating a nationwide telemarketing fraud scheme that targeted older adults. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, victims were defrauded over and over again until they had nothing left. As millions of stunned viewers tuned in, Shah was arrested while the cameras were rolling. Rapidly advancing technological innovations have allowed for more sophisticated online fraud as well. Over the past few years, cryptocurrency scams have been on the rise, as have online romance scams, government impersonation scams, and tech support scams. In August, popular YouTube account Scammer Payback held a gathering of hackers intent on outing some of the perpetrators of online scams. The hackers were able to identify scammers, turn on their webcams, and expose their identities to the authorities. Unfortunately, the huge financial gains reaped year over year through online scams emboldened a new crop of fraudsters for each round of arrests and prosecutions. While anyone can be a victim of financial abuse, older adults often are targeted by scammers because issues that affect the older adult population, like decreased cognitive function, physical disability, and dementia, increase susceptibility to fraud. The impacts of victimization go beyond economic losses. The mental health outcomes include higher rates of PTSD, depression, anxiety, and poorer overall health. However, some victims of elder financial abuse are afraid or ashamed to come forward, so many instances go unreported. In fact, only an estimated 33% of instances of financial abuse perpetrated by a stranger against an older adult are reported to authorities. Tragically, the most likely perpetrator of elder abuse of any kind is a family member or caregiver. These complex ties make reaching out for help even more difficult. A 2022 Iowa law designed to close gaps in the reporting and prosecution of elder abuse identified elder abuse for the first time as an independent category and enhanced the penalties for theft against older adults who were targeted due to their age. Elder abuse can be reported to the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services at its 24-hour hotline, 1-800-362-2178. Another resource older adults or advocates connect with is their local area agency on aging. There are 6 total agencies serving the state of Iowa, and each has staff specifically assigned to support individuals who are experiencing abuse and in need of assistance. You can find the area agency on aging for your region at hhs.iowa.gov/programs/programs-and-services/aging-service/AAAS. The FTC also has created a website for reporting fraud, and it is available at reportfraud.ftc.gov. And turning to the community letters and the editorial cartoon from Joe Heller, who is based in Green Bay. Woman and a man are sitting on their couch. She is showing him her phone turned toward him, and she says, "Here's a post about New Year's resolutions that are doomed from the start." And he says, "Let me guess, getting off social media is number one." The first letter is from Dale Cuter of Cedar Rapids. Dazzled by dazzling lights in Cedar Rapids. Thanks to the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance and businesses downtown in Nubo and the Czech Village for the spectacular Christmas lighting. This was a wow display. It was a delight to see children and parents and grandparents too, excited and having so much fun at the McGrath Amphitheater. It brought back memories of a vibrant downtown shopping district. Here's a prediction. This display will expand and become a major Christmas attraction for our city. Dale Cuter of Cedar Rapids. Next, Richard Gray of North Liberty writes, "Shame on Governor Reynolds for denying extra EBT benefits." Governor Kim Reynolds is doing her best to solve Iowa's 16% child obesity rate. Now she has declined the federal government's offer of extra EBT benefits for children in the summertime. By the way, children's obesity at 16% is nothing compared to Iowa's adult rate of 47%. Her plan of not giving parents an extra $40 per month should be an insult to all Iowans, not just school-age parents. Shame on you, Governor. Controlling obesity by withholding food for children should be a crime. It's good, however, that your refusal of extra benefits over summer vacation happens on the cusp of an election year. Hopefully, Iowans will remember this when they vote. Richard Gray of North Liberty. Next, Douglas Flanagan of Iowa City writes, "All voters should become Republicans on caucus night." I encourage all voters to attend the Republican caucuses February 15th. They're actually January 15th. All non-party voters or those registered in other parties can affiliate with the Republican Party before caucus night or change at the caucus site. This way, Iowa can have the largest voice in who emerges from the First in the Nation caucus primary for the Republican nomination. I am not endorsing any candidate. I believe voters will indicate their preference for the candidate who best represents their values and vision for the future. So let's get going, Iowa, and get the largest turnout possible. Douglas Flanagan of Iowa City. John Klaus, Mount Vernon writes, heartened by Imam's Christmas message. The guest column by Imam Hassan Salim in the Gazette on Christmas Day moved me to tears. Thank you to Imam Salim for writing such a meaningful letter to the Gazette community, and thank you to the Gazette for such a wonderful Christmas present. Blessing be upon Imam Salim and upon the Gazette. I write as a practicing Trinitarian Christian. John Klaus of Mount Vernon. Moretta Portsline of Marion writes, voters really should decide elections. As I read and listen to the news, I keep hearing that voters, not the courts, should decide who should be on the ballot for our elections. It seems to me that the last presidential election was decided by the voters, and the man with the most problems and issues with it didn't want to let the voters decide. Moretta Portsline of Marion. Next, Carolyn Stevenson and Susan Van Wart, co-chairs of the League of Women and Voters of Lean County, write, attend a league forum during legislative session. If asked to list the responsibilities of citizenship, most people would put voting at the top of their list. But do you know which issues are being discussed and voted into law after the election? The 2024 Iowa legislative session begins January 8th. To learn what is happening with the issues you care about, the Lynn County League of Women Voters invites you to participate in our nonpartisan legislative forums. All Lynn County era legislators are invited to participate. Attendees submit the questions they would like the legislators to respond to. Questions are gathered and a moderator poses the questions. Our communities are very fortunate that most of our Lynn County legislators participate, and they value the transparency the forums provide. The League's first 2024 Legislative Forum will be held January 20th at the Marion Public Library. All forums are held from 10 to 11:30 a.m. on the third Saturday of the month during the legislative session. What happens in the Iowa Capitol affects our local governments, K-12 public schools, area education agencies, community colleges, and Regent universities. Iowa legislation determines access and funding for basic services. Current issues under consideration include further lowering of personal income tax, the elimination or restructuring of a large number of licensing boards, and the state's requirement for gender equity on boards, commissions, and committees. The local forums are an opportunity for your legislator to hear your concerns. We hope you attend and participate. Carolyn Stevenson and Susan Van Wart, co-chairs, League of Women Voters of Lynn County. And the final letter is from Ann Fellows Christensen of Coralville. Laws preempting personal decisions can cause suffering. 3 months ago, my oncologist predicted that without further treatment of my cancer, I had 3 to 6 months to live. Whether treatment would make a difference was questionable. The treatment would likely be very uncomfortable and disruptive. Odds of a significant response were very poor. At age 87, should I take on another round of chemo or immunotherapy? After discussions with family and doctors, I opted to forego further treatment. Since then, I have had the opportunity to celebrate my life with those whose causes I share. I have been comfortable with this choice, and thanks to Iowa City Hospice, have not suffered. In fact, life these past weeks has been good, filled with supportive friends and relatives. Had I chosen treatment, those weeks could have been miserable. Should someone else have had a say in my decision? Should some elected official deny me this choice? I am, in a way, taking my own life. Is this different from the pregnant women with crises threatening their lives or those of their fetuses? How can anyone presume to know what is best in such a pregnancy? Other than the woman and her doctors, this is no one else's business. After all, this is her life, her body, her choice. Not mine, not yours. Ann Fellows Christensen of Coralville. And some quotes of the week. First, Iowa State Patrol Sergeant Alex Dinkla explaining one factor in a 10% increase in Iowa traffic fatalities in 2023. We're already seeing two problematic trends with crashes, intersection-related crashes and lane departures. Both of those lean toward people being distracted. Next, Cedar Rapids Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell discussing the possibility of building a multi-million dollar dual-use intergenerational center and sports complex. Mayor O'Donnell said, I would love to see Cedar Rapids be a place that is known for our work in supporting mature adults or opportunities for adults to age well. This is not just about building a new building. For me as mayor, it's also about how do we as a city position ourselves as the most age-friendly in the Midwest. Chip Hardesty, age 80, longtime tennis coach at City High School, explaining the immediate help he received while suffering cardiac arrest from Iowa City Police Officer Andy Farrell. Coach Hardesty says, I couldn't have been more lucky to have an officer there, a former EMT, and have an ambulance nearby. If it happened at home, it might not have been a good outcome. And finally, State Senator Sarah Trone-Garriott, Democrat West Des Moines, reacting to Governor Kim Reynolds' decision for turning down federal dollars for kids' summer meals. Representative Garriott says, or Senator Garriott says, it's a huge loss for Iowa. If we're talking 20-some billion dollars coming from the federal government, I don't think the state is going to be matching that. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 31st, 2023, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we turn to today's obituaries. Robert James Cabela, age 89, of Solon, passed away on December 26th at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A celebration of life gathering will be from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, January 27th, at Palmer House Stable, 200 East Main Street in Solon. A brief service will begin at 1 p.m., followed by a dessert reception. The private family interment will be in Oakland Cemetery. Robert worked for 37 years at Procter & Gamble in Iowa City, and Bob started running at age 50, participating in countless 5K races, spent some time and money in Las Vegas over the years. With a passion for ice cream and cookies, he never turned down a free meal, but he was endlessly generous and supportive of everyone who loved him. Jolene R. Kirkpatrick, age 74, of Yates Center, Kansas, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away after a brief illness at Chanute Hospital in Kansas on December 14th. Services, 11 a.m. Saturday, January 6th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, where visitation will start at 10 a.m. The service will be presided by William Kirkpatrick. Jolene's career served the special needs of individuals for many years at Options of Linn County of Cedar Rapids until her retirement in 2009. She continued to volunteer, assisting the disabled in her community and in many ways. Some of Jolene's favorite things to do included reading, sharing time with family and grandchildren, the disabled, and church activities. She lived and loved her walk with Jesus and took time to share her faith and love Christ had for all of them. Bernard Brown, known as Bernie, age 83, of Swisher, died December 26th after his final health battle with cancer. He passed at his home with his family by his side. A visitation will be held from noon to 1:15 p.m. Saturday, January 6th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will follow at 1:30 with a reception immediately after, all at the funeral home. On Monday, January 8th, Bernie will be laid to rest at the old Lugutti Cemetery in Lugutti, Illinois. Bernie served in the United States Navy from 1963 to 1965 on the USS Everglades. After college, he worked as a junior high school teacher and coach in Rochester, Illinois. He then entered the Federal Bureau of Investigation and worked as a special agent for 23 years until his retirement in 1994. During his tenure as an FBI agent, he served in field offices in Mississippi, Texas, New York, and Iowa. Over his career, criminal convictions resulted from his investigations into civil rights crimes, motorcycle gang activity, organized crime, white supremacist terrorism, and foreign espionage. Bernie enjoyed following Iowa Hawkeye athletics and was most at peace on his farm in Swisher. Jeanette Louisa McClurg, age 84, of Cedar Rapids, passed away December 22nd at Emory Place in Robbins. Services will be held Wednesday, January 3rd at 1 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held Tuesday, January 2nd, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Chapel of Memories State Room, burial Shiloh Cemetery in Hiawatha. Jeanette worked for Rockwell Collins, retiring in 1995 with 36 years, and then worked for Sears as a cashier for 14 years. She was a member of Ashley Chapter DAR and very much interested in genealogy research. She was a member of Knoll Ridge Christian Church in Cedar Rapids. Donald B. Campbell, age 88, of Galena, Illinois, died peacefully on December 22nd. The Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena is assisting the family. A memorial service will be held at a future date. Donald and his wife both loved Galena's natural beauty, engaging community, and diverse plants and wildlife. Karen Jean Bales, age 74, of Loudoun, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away Monday, December 25th at the Anamosa Care Center. Visitation will be from 12 to 3 p.m. Saturday, January 6th at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Celebration of life will begin at 5 p.m. at the Tipton VFW on Saturday, January 6th. H.J. Koss, known as Jim, age 93, peacefully departed this world on December 26th, surrounded by his loving family. Jim served with honor in the U.S. Marine Corps from 1948 to 1952, courageously fighting in the Korean War. His bravery earned him 2 Purple Hearts and the Bronze Star. A successful career as project manager with General Growth Properties showcased his engineering excellence building regional malls. A man of faith, Jim will be remembered for his unwavering commitment to his moral principle and a legacy of resilience. The family will gather in a private ceremony to celebrate a remarkable 9 decades of love and laughter. Per his wishes, his body has been donated to the University of Iowa for medical research. Brian Henry Ulrichs, age 55, of Monticello, passed away in the company of his family at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics on December 23rd. Visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, January 3rd, at Saints Peter and Paul Lutheran Church in Monticello. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, January 4th, at Saints Peter and Paul Lutheran Church in Monticello. Pastor Holly Knaus will officiate. Brian worked a variety of jobs throughout his life, most notably at the Anamosa State Penitentiary for 31 years. As a recent retiree, Brian enjoyed working in his shop, spending time with his family, and watching his favorite Western films. Brian will best be remembered through his lively storytelling, his fondness for chocolate, and his unconditional love for wife and children. David Thomas Teed, age 64, of Lamarck, Texas, formerly of Palo, died December 26th. Services at a later date. After high school, Dave headed south to pursue warmer weather and his dream of working on cars, making a career working in several auto body shops in the Houston, Texas area. He retired in the spring of 2023. Gary Lynn Nosek, age 73, of Marion, passed away Thursday, December 28th at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 11 a.m. on Friday, January 5th, at Troy Mills Christian Church. Memorial service will follow at 11 a.m. Friday at the church with Pastor Don McGarvey officiating. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Gary worked at Rockwell Collins for 20 years, then the Gazette for 5 years, and Cargill for 5 years until his retirement in 2012. Gary was a member of the Troy Mills Christian Church. Juanita Marie Rowling, age 81, of Cedar Rapids, passed away December 28th at St. Luke's Transitional Care Center in Cedar Rapids. The family will greet friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, January 2nd, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, with a vigil service starting at 3:30 p.m. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 on Wednesday, January 3rd at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church in Hiawatha, with an additional one-hour visitation starting at 9:30 before the service. A burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Juanita taught at Clinton High School in Clinton, Iowa, and Regis High School in Cedar Rapids, and later served as Religious Education Office Manager at St. Pius Parish in Cedar Rapids before retiring in 2002. She was a member of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Parish and the Regis Rockers. Juanita enjoyed gardening, biking, and collecting milk glass. She specialized in creating greeting cards from scratch and spending time with her grandchildren. Madeline Frances Waterter, age 79, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully at home on December 22nd. A visitation will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom on Thursday, January 4th, from 4 to 7 p.m. A funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories on Friday, January 5th, with burial following the service. Madeline originally went to work to be a teacher and did work for a few years as a music teacher. Then she gave over 30 years of service to CRST. She was a member of the Cedar Rapids Corvette Club for 25 years, and for 10 of those years, she was the secretary. She loved to knit and make many baby blankets, afghans, booties, and hats for her grandsons. Madeline was an avid reader, and there were very few books that she didn't read. Dimitra S. Margelos, known as Tula of Cedar Rapids, age 90, passed away peacefully surrounded by family on December 27th. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, January 3rd at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, with a Trisagion service beginning at 7 p.m. A funeral service will take place at 10 a.m. on January 4th at St. John the Baptist Greek Orthodox Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Tula worked for the local unemployment office, WMT-TV, and Rockwell Collins, where she retired from in 1995. She was a member of St. John the Baptist Greek Orthodox Church, St. John Lady Philoptokos Society, and Daughters of Penelope. Tula was a caring, spunky, feisty, and loving wife, mother, and yaya. Once you met Tula and her flashy glasses, you never forgot her. She loved baking, cooking French food, bowling, playing cards, especially 80 cents, with her friends, and Tula enjoyed going to breakfast on Saturdays at Hy-Vee, watching football of any kind, and the Game Show Network. Larry Allen Smith of Vinton passed away in his sleep at home in Vinton on December 16th. As per Larry's wishes, there will be no service at this time. Larry worked in manufacturing businesses throughout the years, including Collins Radio and Lefebvre in Cedar Rapids, Winnebago in Forest City, Graber in Bensonville, Illinois, and Fisher Scientific in Indiana, Pennsylvania. His focus on being operations and inventory control. Towards the end of his work life, he stepped away to be caregiver for his mother before she passed away in 2006. James Edward Koss, age 81, of Solon, passed away on December 20th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha from a brief illness. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, January 3rd at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Solon. Funeral Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, January 4th at St. Mary's. Burial will follow in St. Bridget's Cemetery, Nolan Settlement. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon is charge of arrangements. Leona Ann Schrammack, age 81, of Solon, passed away December 26th at Colonial Manicare Center in Amana, surrounded by her family. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, January 2nd at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Celebration of Life service will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, January 3rd at Brosh Chapel. A burial will follow at Anderson Cemetery in Swisher. Leona worked at the Cedar Rapids Gazette from January 3, 1978 until retiring on December 31, 2002. She enjoyed camping, dancing, listening to Czech and country music, playing marbles and cards, and spending time with friends and family. Turning to the sports page, Iowa football, plenty of time. Ference hopes players soak in specialness of trip before making decisions on future, by John Stepp of the Gazette in Orlando. Kirk Ferentz remembers a noisy stay in Tampa before one of his six Outback Bowl appearances as Iowa's head football coach. "You stay right there on the bay," Ferentz said. "New Year's Eve is wild down there, just loud, and the hotel we were in was like the place to be, apparently. You couldn't sleep." Iowa now stays off-site the night before to avoid such a distraction, but a different type of distraction is harder to avoid. Looming decisions for players who could come back or move on to the NFL or their post-football lives. Tight end Luke Lachey, linebacker Jay Higgins, and offensive lineman Nick DeJong have already announced plans to stay. Defensive backs Cooper DeJean, Sebastian Castro, Quinn Schulte, and Jamari Harris have decisions to announce. "I don't want to speak for the other guys," Ferentz said. "My sense is they're all different stories and they're all going at their different rates." Regardless of where on the stay-or-go spectrum might be, Ferentz has a request for all of his players who have decisions to make. "Don't be distracted this week with whatever you're thinking about," Ferentz said. "If you want to announce, great. If you don't, hold off. That's great, too. I've witnessed that in the last couple of years, some guys have done a better job of that than others." That may be easier for Ferentz to say than for athletes to do, especially given the high stakes. Spotrac projects that the 12th overall pick in next year's NFL draft would receive a $10 million signing bonus. The 32nd pick is projected to receive a $5.7 million signing bonus. "It's a big decision, so it's easy to understand why they might be distracted," Ferentz said. "But I also try to reinforce that you only have so many chances to play in a football game during your career. Don't let the specialness of this event be diminished by maybe some things that are on your mind." Ferentz and the undecided players have conversations before traveling to the bowl site, but there is very little discussion here about their futures while on the trip. "If one of the players wants to talk, we'd be happy to visit with them," Ferentz said. Some schools have a litany of opt-outs as players avoid the risk of an injury in the bowl game, but no Hawkeyes have opted out of Monday's Citrus Bowl. Kayvon Merriweather was the only Hawkeye to opt out in 2022, and Tyler Goodson was the only Hawkeye to opt out in 2021. One of the perks of waiting to make a decision until after January is having more time to receive feedback from the NFL rather than from advisors who might have an agenda. "Certainly the NFL people know more in January than they did 4 weeks ago," Ferentz said. "We'll try to get them on the phone with anybody they need to be on the phone with, all that kind of stuff, so they are getting accurate information from the people who do it for a living." The deadline for entering the NFL draft is January 15th, 2 weeks after the Citrus Bowl. "The guys that haven't made up their minds have plenty of time when we get back," Ferentz said. Mike Kloss writes in his column, this is J.R. Ogden. Top story in 2023 was kind of obvious. Caitlin Clark and the Iowa women are an easy pick. This was easy, a no-brainer, as some like to say. When looking back at the top stories of 2023, which we media folks like to do each year at this time, the top story in eastern Iowa was pretty obvious. It's definitely the top story across all of Iowa too, maybe across the Midwest, and quite possibly in all of the Big Ten Conference from coast to coast. The Iowa women's basketball team went from good to great to downright enchanting. You couldn't take your eyes off this team, either in person or on TV. Led by GOAT Caitlin Clark, player of the year seems like it doesn't quite capture her stature, Iowa went 31-7, finished second in the Big Ten regular season standings, won the conference tournament again, then reeled off five NCAA tournament wins, including a memorable 77-73 win over South Carolina in the semifinals, before falling to LSU in the national title game. Along the way, there were many thrilling moments, like the regular season-ending 86-85 victory over Indiana on a Clark prayer. The thing is, these wins were only part of this wonderful story. They were an important part, of course, but it was the way Lisa Bluter's team captivated its fans and how this program elevated women's basketball to new heights. Even more important was that it generated more fans, and not only in Iowa. This season sold out soon after tickets became available. The team drew 55,646 fans to Kinnick Stadium for an exhibition game against DePaul in October, dubbed the Crossover at Kinnick. The team stands number 4 in the country right now, is 13-1, and has won 10 in a row after Saturday's victory over Minnesota. And we've barely mentioned Clark, the engine who makes this team run so smoothly. She won every major award available last season and is leading the country in scoring right now. But her numbers, too, only tell part of her story. The way she plays the game with brash playfulness is mesmerizing. She's good, she knows she's good, yet still plays like a kid having the time of her life dribbling, passing, and shooting. She alone has helped women's basketball become more relevant everywhere, especially when the Hawkeyes come to town. Arenas that usually sit half empty are selling out because people want to see her do what she does. It's been an enjoyable ride that continues to this day. This story is still being told and may get even better. While the Iowa women's basketball run was an easy choice as story of the year, there were many compelling stories in Eastern Iowa in 2023. Here are the others in no particular order. The Hawkeye football team won 10 times and played in the Big Ten championship game despite its offense being one of the worst in the country, and its offensive coordinator and head coach's son getting canned midway through the season by the interim athletics director, his interim boss. But Brian Ferentz has kept that job until after Monday's bowl game. If Iowa can beat a depleted Tennessee team in the Citrus Bowl, it'll be among a select few with 11 wins in 2023. Odd, indeed, but what a success story for the players. The Iowa State football team, led by a first-year quarterback, went from 4-8 in 2022 to 7-6 in 2023 after Friday's loss to Memphis in the Liberty Bowl. Matt Campbell continues to do fantastic work in Ames. And the Iowa and ISU teams were rocked by the gambling scandal that engulfed the state, and only this state, when players in a variety of sports were suspended or ruled ineligible to compete. The Iowa men's wrestling team may have been the hardest hit, losing several of its returning starters. Speaking of Iowa wrestling, another top story in 2023 was Spencer Lee falling in the NCAA tournament in his quest to become Iowa's first four-time national champ. Healthy now, Lee has bounced back recently, winning a U.S. Senior Nationals freestyle title in his run for a 2024 Olympics berth. Wrestling also had a milestone this year. The first season sanctioned by the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union took place with lots of new wrestlers and new teams and the state tournament at the Extreme Arena in Coralville and was a huge success. The Iowa women's wrestling team also got its first official season started, and the Hawkeyes have not disappointed. They are ranked number one. Can they be 1-2 and have been dominating their competition? Another big story among colleges in Iowa was the expansion of the Big Ten to 18 teams and Big 12 to 16. Those football and basketball schedules will look a lot different in 2024, with cross-country trips galore. Iowa plays a regular season football game in Pasadena, California, ISU in Salt Lake City, Utah. Among the top high school stories of the year is the success at Williamsburg. The Raiders won three straight state titles to close 2023, boys track and field in the spring, softball in the summer, and football in the fall. The Cedar Rapids Colonels also reached rarefied air, winning the Midwest League title in the fall. And let's not forget a couple of national stories with Iowa ties. What former Iowa State quarterback Brock Purdy has done with the San Francisco 49ers is remarkable. He's gone from Mr. Irrelevant, the last person taken in the 2022 draft, to being in the conversation for the NFL MVP in 2023. Another former Cyclone, Tyrese Halliburton, has become a rising star in the NBA, leading the Indiana Pacers to the championship game of the inaugural in-season tournament. And Cedar Rapids' own Murray brothers are NBA twins. Chris, a first-round draft pick of the Portland Trailblazers in 2023, a year after his brother Keegan was picked fourth by the Sacramento Kings. Keegan made the all-rookie team in 2023 and recently dropped 47 points in a game that included 12 three-pointers, including an NBA record 11 in a row. Now let's sit back and enjoy the last day of the year and anticipate what 2024 will bring. Happy New Year! And the History Happenings column from Jessica Klein and Rob Klein. Jessica Klein is a leadership and character scholar at Wake Forest University, and her dad, Rob Klein, is not a scholar of any kind. They write this monthly column for the History Center. Page 1 on the holidays. The news continues even while most people are celebrating. For those who celebrate, Christmas seems like a day set apart from all the turmoil of day-to-day living. Still in all, the news still gets reported on the holiday, and we were interested in what news might have been delivered to readers of the local press along with Santa's gifts. Take, for example, the front page of the Cedar Rapids Tribune, a newspaper without a muzzle, on Friday, December 25th, 1925. That Christmas, there were five headlines across the top of the page. Green Deal smashing blow to alien agents who promote fascism. German Unionist unfolds tale of red wrecking in the fatherland. Trailing in the wake of the news, shall charity be dispensed with kindly heart or mean tongue. Spirit of peace marks industry as the year end, says Secretary Davis, principles underlying the golden rule gaining strength daily, and closing year finds employment steady throughout nation. The positioning of ideas like smashing and wrecking alongside notions of charity, perhaps delivered meanly, and peace is striking, but at least employment was steady. 1930, festive and fatals. On Christmas Day 1930, the Evening Gazette and Republican, 3 cents in the city, 5 cents on trains, published a festive holiday header, but the news was less cheery. 13 killed in 3 motor accidents. That day's current comment feature, written by Vern Marshall and located on the front page, opened this way. The Christian world still has a great distance to go before it masses its undoubted strength in one mighty driver for the realization of the goal of all its creeds. What can the various creeds agree on? According to Marshall, just one thing. They are all willing to admit that Jesus was born and that December 25th is his birthday. That last bit is probably on some shaky historical ground. World War II. World War II was underway when Christmas Day came around in 1940. The United States had not entered the war yet, but issues related to it were emblazoned across the front page of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Iowa interests first. The main headline read, Wheeler Aid Plan Illegal, and the accompanying story quoted U.S. Senator Burton K. Wheeler, Democrat Montana, arguing that President Roosevelt should not send aid to Britain, but should instead bring the warring factions together and insist on a just peace. 20 years later, the Cedar Rapids Gazette, 15 cents, greeted Christmas with the headline, New Berlin Crisis Feared. The story speculated about a potential conflict due to the failure of West Germany and Communist East Germany to sign a trade pact. Also at the top of the page that year, a cartoon in which Mrs. Claus says to a footsore Santa, It took longer this year. Santa blamed the pressures and conventions of modern life. Think of the population increase. People stay up later watching TV. More parties. It's hard to get in. Biblical references. An illustration of Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus, along with some shepherds, wise men, angels, and camels, dominated the front page of the Gazette on Christmas 1980. In 2000, the header on the front page quoted Luke's account of the birth of Christ, but immediately under the masthead it was all football. Mild concussion sidelines Kurt Warner in the upcoming Super Bowl, and ISU fans in Phoenix rise to the occasion about the Cyclones going to the Insight.com Bowl. 2020, tough year. On December 25th, 2020, the Gazette, Eastern Iowa's independent, employee-owned newspaper, led with, The safety net has a big hole. Food pantries cope with astonishing need. Linn County, like everywhere, was still in the grips of the pandemic. The county also had suffered the devastation of the August 10th derecho. The pandemic and in Iowa, the derecho, have laid bare the poverty and systemic inequities that have long existed in the world's wealthiest exposing how individuals have fallen through the cracks of support systems, reporter Marissa Payne wrote. The good news in 2020 was that many organizations and individuals stepped up to help, answering that Christmas Day question from way back in 1925, shall charity be dispensed with kindly heart or mean tongue? Decidedly in favor of kindly heart. We wish you and yours peace and happiness, however you celebrate, as the year comes to a close. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 31st, 2023. Hope your 2023 treated you well and that 2024 also brings you something to look forward to. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.